This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Trouble at the Today Show with Matt Lauer. We go there now on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tactics. It's great to be with each and every one of you. This story is so fresh, I don't even have any notes on it. I'm just going off the cuff here. But this broke this morning. Matt Lauer, of course, being let go from the Today Show. Been there for goodness knows how long. Long as I can remember, which, I mean, I know I'm 28, so that's not very long. But in comparison to some of you, at least. But Matt Lauer, been on the Today Show for a really long time. Long time Today Show host. Now is the latest victim in the string of sexual assaults and sexual harassment allegations. They didn't say exactly whether it was harassment or assault or whether there's anything legal going on. This is very new. We don't have a lot of details. Latest I've heard is just that it was some kind of sexual misconduct, which is very vague. I understand why NBC is playing this close to the chest. He wasn't there yesterday, and then they announced this morning on the Today Show that he had been let go, and that was the reason. Now, there's a political show that I watch quite a bit, Ben Shapiro. Y'all know that I've talked about him before, and they actually have a counter, Days Without Incident, where it comes to people being accused, new sexual allegations against somebody. They're having to reset it. Like, I don't think it's ever gotten past two. So this is something that I'm not trying to make light of, but it is kind of humorous that we can not seem to go but maybe one or two days without new allegations of sexual harassment or sexual assault coming out, which is a real tragedy. Now, a lot of this could be because it's a fad, it's trendy, and because a lot of that, there are people now that are trying to capitalize upon that, trying to make some money off of it, trying to get their 15 seconds of fame, whatever it may be. But there are probably at least several of, I would say several, maybe not most, maybe not the majority, but several of these that actually has some legs to it. And we've seen that with, for example, Al Franken. You know, we don't know necessarily about John Conyers. We don't know about Roy Moore, but we know for a fact that Al Franken did what he did because, well, there's a picture of it. We don't know about some of the other allegations, but we do know for a fact that that's the case. There are a lot of people. Kevin Spacey basically admitted to at least some of his allegations, so we know that that one's at least partially true. And so people in Hollywood, people in Washington, people that are just famous in general are being accused of these things. And it really is interesting. We are seemingly at a turning point in our country when it comes to all these allegations of some kind of sexual misconduct. Now, in Matt Lauer's case, I'm not going to speculate. I'm not going to throw out innuendo. I'm not going to try to break the story because it's new. I'm just going to tell you what I know so far, which is very little. And I'm reserving having any opinions on it or holding out judgment until later, but this is what I do think. Based on the way that NBC handled this, and based on the way that they phrased it, and based on some of the details they gave us this morning, because one thing they did say is that we believe this may not be an isolated incident, which means there are probably multiple allegations that NBC is aware of. There's one that I think they're pretty certain will come out, which is why they went ahead and pulled the plug. But it seems to me incredibly odd that they would go ahead and just pull the plug on somebody, especially somebody with the value as a host that Matt Lauer has. And he does have a great deal of value. I mean, he's been the host of the Today Show for as long as he has, which means that if they were pulling the plug on him, they at least believe that this story has some legs. They wouldn't do this if they thought the accusations had absolutely no credibility, or at least I don't think that they would. And they believe that, I think they were trying to get out ahead of this because they know that there's more to come. I don't know that. That's just what I'm guessing based on the data that they've given us so far. Could be wrong. And so I want to give that very serious, very heavy disclaimer out right now. But if I had to guess, there's more to this story than they're telling us, at least for right now. I'm really not sure as to whether that's the case or not, but I'm just going to go ahead and tell you the facts, and then based on that, I get the feeling that I cannot confirm or deny right now because of how early this is, that there is going to be more to this story coming out in the next few days. So be on the lookout for that. It seems that we have a caller on line one, so we'll go ahead and jump to the phones. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Caleb.
Hey, what's your name?
Hey, a couple of quick questions for you. So back to the governor's thing, the race, or the senator race, Moore and Jones.
Okay.
Do you believe with almost 100% certainty either Moore or Jones will be the next senator?
If you're looking at history, then yeah, pretty much. I mean, unless there are a couple things that could happen. Something could come out that proves Roy Moore is guilty very late in the game, and then Roy Moore would see that he has no choice but to step aside, and then somebody else would come in and the GOP would support a third-party candidate. That could happen. But by and large, there's a very, very real possibility that one of those two is going to be the next senator. If the polls are to believe, it'll be Roy Moore.
Okay. Yeah, and I wrestle with it all, too, and I guess I just kind of look at it as though, let's just say everything about Moore was true. Let's just say it's 100% true. So now I have...
You're talking about the allegations, correct?
Yes, the allegations.
Okay.
Not jurisprudence or anything else, but
let's just say
it's all true.
Okay.
Well, the other thing we know that is 100% true is the positions of his opponent. And, of course, with regard to, you know, abortion, he's 100% behind abortion. So I go, do I want to elect a guy who is a sexual assaulter from 30 or 40 years ago, let's just say, or do I want to elect a guy that still advocates the murder of 4,000 unborn babies every single day? And I go, gosh, if that's my number one criteria, it's a no-brainer for me. So anyway, what do you think about that?
What do you think about my reaction to your decision or the scenario as a whole?
Not the scenario as a whole, but the fact that, hey, you know, we have one guy that does say he is absolutely pro-life, and you have another guy that's absolutely pro-abortion. So everything else notwithstanding, you know, you can decide up or down on all the other issues. But we know on those moral issues as a Christian, one of them is on one side and one of them is on the other side. So how does that grab you?
Totally understand your thought process. And it's one that I'm sympathetic to because abortion is my number one issue. In fact, if you are pro-abortion, there is absolutely no chance you'll get my vote, even if you agree with me on every other thing. So
I agree with you, Caleb.
100% understand your thought process on that. When it comes to Judge Moore, though, or any election, I think that we sometimes fall into the trap of the false dichotomy fallacy, which is that there are only two options. And so in that position, I would have to take a third party if all the allegations happen to be true. I would wind up writing somebody in or something like that.
That's why I kind of asked you in the beginning, do you really only believe it? It's almost like the presidential election. I know you weren't a Trump guy.
Right.
But either Hillary or Trump was going to be the president. And I think we're almost in that same position now. It's not really a false dichotomy. It's just the reality of the dichotomy. We don't like it. And we have to decide who
a false dichotomy fallacy, to explain what that is it is a argument that you only have two choices. Whereas in an election, you have several choices. You can vote for one of the major party candidates. You can write in. You can stay home. You have a lot of options when that happens.
But you only have one realistic option as to one of those two people was going to become president. So I can decide to not vote, or I can decide to try to have the person that I wanted to win, even if I like neither one.
Of course.
Yeah. And I think that's the same situation between Moore and Jones. We don't like Moore because of all this stuff, and there's probably some truth to it. But we dislike the other guy for obviously, you know, the reasons aforementioned. So,
I just see it's very similar. Oh, I think it is very similar, and I think that that's the exact same problem that a lot of people are grappling with. Because I personally know a lot of people that were not big fans of Trump, but wound up voting for him anyway, because they believed that the option was either him or Hillary. The difference that I see it, though, and this is just where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
When it comes to a vote, The purpose of a vote is for me to send out a message and represent to my government the kind of person that I want representing my values. If it turns out that Moore has done what he has done, Moore no longer represents my values, ergo, since the purpose of my vote is to represent my values, I cannot use my vote in support of Moore. However, as of now, even though I believe there's some truth to the allegation that he was pursuing women that were either very close to the age of consent or below the age of consent, there is no proof that he did any of the illegal right. activities that he is accused of, and thus, until they can prove that, my vote will go to Judge Moore.
Yeah. So even if they were provable, let's just say, then would you not vote?
Well, I would vote. I would write somebody in. I'd probably vote write in Mo Brooks. That would probably be what I would do.
And then you would be prepared to live with Jones winning.
Right. I cannot take responsibility, moral or otherwise, for the actions of other people, but I can take responsibility for
right.
what I do.
Okay.
And that's how I see it, because I would have to answer for voting somebody who I believed was dishonest.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. thank you so much for your call. I got a break coming up, but it was good talking to you. All right. And with that, we will go to a break. Last night was debate night, CNN, with Senators Scott, Cruz, Sanders, and I'd have to look at my notes for that one. We had four senators, and the last one is escaping me, but I will have that for you when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The general principles on which the fathers achieve independence were the general principles of Christianity. John Adams.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in and let me know what is on your mind. There was a big debate on last night, the CNN debate they had with four different senators. And one of the things that I wanted to bring up is just kind of give you a little bit of a rehash. To be honest, though, and I have to be forthcoming with my audience, the truth is I didn't see the whole thing. Because as those of you who may not know, I know that most of you do, I actually have just been recently diagnosed with cancer, and I was going through chemotherapy, and they put me on some real good stuff called Ativan that, boy, that knocks you out. And I got home and went immediately to bed, and I slept till about 8:30, 8:45. And so by the time I woke up, the debate was well over halfway over when I started watching. I think I started watching about 8:50. So I'm not going to talk about the whole thing. And if I do say something that I missed, you know, I'm not going to talk about what they excluded because, again, I don't really know. I only saw the last part of it. But I did want to go ahead and give you my rehash of what I did see. This debate was, of course, on the tax bill that is before Congress. Apparently, this conflicted with the Victoria's Secret fashion show on CBS, which I don't know why you would want to watch that when you could be watching a debate about tax policy. See, that to me is really the because I'm a huge nerd. That's what I would rather watch. But anyway. So what I did see was fine, but I got to be honest, the format just really sucks. And this is something that I've been complaining about with CNN, and not just CNN, but the other networks, because they do very similar things too. What bugs me is this town hall format. The town hall format is dumb because it's a bunch of people who are not experts asking questions, which normally isn't a bad thing, but in the format of a debate, the reason that's problematic is because, especially when you're dealing with politicians, if the question is not worded in such a way that it's airtight and it's very direct, or it goes too long, then the politician can just dodge saying what he actually and just go into basically one of his pre-planned talking points. The advantage of having somebody who's a news person word these questions is because they're aware of that and then adjust the questions and their wording accordingly. And so what normally happens is the person asks the question, the politician dodges the question, and then the news personality jumps in and gives a more tightly worded question, and then the politician is forced to either answer it or go away. So essentially what we've done here is we've just wasted a lot of time. And that's the reason I really have a problem with the whole town hall thing. I know I complained about it a lot, but It really does get on my nerves. Another thing, too, it was almost impossible to keep everything straight with four people on the stage. It was almost impossible to get everybody's opinion on each question, and there was a lot of interruption, and it just seemed disorderly. Now, in a presidential debate, that is a necessary evil because you've got several candidates, especially with the Republican primary this last time where they had like 16 candidates. And I know that they were able to split it up into two different ones, but when you've got a lot of people on stage, that is something that they have to do because all those people are candidates. That is not something you have to do when you're debating a particular issue between people who have already been elected. And so, frankly, I like the format much better when they did it just Ted Cruz or Bernie Sanders or, you know, just Paul Ryan and somebody else. When they do those debates where it's just them and one other person, I think that that is a far more beneficial way to conduct a debate, and you get a lot more information and you can keep up with who's talking and who was asked what question. It just, to me, it was utter chaos last night with having four people. I'm glad that they didn't decide to go with more, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of the chaos that ensued on the Republican and, to a much lesser extent, the Democrat primaries when they held their debates. So, you know, the debate is, overall, content aside, the format needs some work, and that's my advice to CNN. But nonetheless, we did actually get to some policy stuff. Now, Bernie did what Bernie always does. I think Bernie forgot to take his medication because he seemed a little bit extra unhinged last night. Maybe it was because he was also confused at the four people being there. I'm not really sure. But and maybe that was what got under his skin, the same thing that got under mine. But anyway, Bernie seemed a little extra agitated, even more so than usual. And he went into his bag of about six phrases and just repeated them all night, which is what you expect Bernie to do. So he just said the 1%, the rich, the middle class, the super rich, working Americans, only country that, and insert whatever, you know, crazy socialist thing that he wants here, and then living wage. And he just said those about 50 times last night. And I mean, that's what you expect from an appearance from Bernie Sanders. You know, he'll occasionally make a good point, but most of the time he just uses the same list of vague platitudes that have nothing to do with reality. And that's the problem with that I have with Bernie, is when he talks about things, he talks about the way he thinks things should be, which is okay, at least from time to time. I mean, especially if you're an ideologue like Sanders, you have to do that sometimes because that's part of your message. But especially when you're debating something specific like this, the problem that I had with it is that he's going into his thoughts about the way things ought to be as opposed to actually giving facts, statistics, and numbers. And especially when you're debating something as technical as taxes, I don't really care what you think things ought to be or, you know, where you think that such and such could go if we enacted such program. Give me numbers. Give me statistics. Give me facts. Give me something to chew on. I mean, basically, all taxes boil down to his math, and so I don't think it's too much to ask for Bernie Sanders to use at least a statistic here and there. But I didn't see very much of that. Maybe he did it earlier in the debate. I rather doubt it, and I missed it, but usually he doesn't. He just sticks to whatever crazy socialist thing that pops into his head at the moment. But anyway, we'll have a little bit more on that when we come back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. At Tactics Radio is the Twitter handle if you want to get in touch with me that way, which, of course, you can always do. Now, talking a little bit more about the CNN debate that was going on last night. So, as I said, Bernie basically just had about six or seven crutch words that he used and used them over and over and over again. I mean, that's what he does. He talks about the 1% and the rich and the wealthiest and so on and so forth, and that's about all he knows how to do. Debate-wise, he's just not the best representative for the Democrats. I actually thought that the other Democrat Senator Cantwell, I didn't agree with much of what she said, but at least she was in the habit of making better points and attempting to form an argument, whereas Bernie mostly just talked about how it's terrible that we're different from every other country in the world, which if Bernie is so convinced every other country is so far ahead of us, I don't know why he doesn't move to one of those countries, but regardless. Furthermore, I do not drink. I have never drank. I do not advocate for drinking. If you do, that's not necessarily something that is prohibited. I'm just saying that I personally think that it's smarter not to drink. However, if you were playing a drinking game with the debate last night, and you included a few of those phrases that I'm talking about, no human could withstand that level of alcohol poisoning. So please don't do that, especially when it comes to Bernie Sanders. But the thing is, these buzzwords, the reason that they are unproductive in an intellectual discussion is because they are a way to prevent you from thinking. Because what they do is they get the people that are on Bernie's side riled up, and they get people that are not on Bernie's side upset, but they don't really do much more than that. They do not invoke some kind of critical thought into the merits of his argument. They just are the ramblings of a confused old man. And because of that, because he only knows how to do that, watching the debate, at least from Bernie's perspective, does very little to stimulate your thought process. Even me, who is a political analyst and trying to look at things critically and trying to break down his argument and see, okay, what is he actually saying when he says, honestly, it's hard to follow because you can tell that those buzzwords are designed specifically to shut down discussion, not invoke more thought. And because he relies on them so incredibly heavily, it's hard to even understand what he's saying sometimes. Or if you aren't looking for the deeper meaning, you just kind of assume that he's saying the same answer for every question. But nonetheless, these are mostly vague, empty platitudes about fairness, but they have no basis in reality. Like I said before, he rarely ever gives a statistic or talks about what the effects of a policy will actually be, or gives an example of like another state or another country that did this, where it worked or where it didn't. Usually it's just, well, it doesn't matter whether the policy works or not, it's fair. Well, the problem with socialism is whether or not it's fair or not. I mean, everybody being equally miserable is fair. Like, Venezuela is a very fair country right now. Pretty much everybody has to stand in line for 2 hours to get a can of beans. That's fair. Everybody's pretty much in the same boat except for the elites. So there is more fairness, if you want to use the technical term, than there is here in America. Because they did jump on board with the socialist policies that Bernie is saying we should do. But just because it's fair doesn't make it better. That's the problem with socialism. All it does is it spreads misery around equally. Now, Cruz and Scott were largely statistic and fact-based in contrast to Bernie. In fact, Cruz used so many stats that Jake Tapper had to ask him to stop to go to a commercial break because they had those breaks. And I understand that, being a broadcaster myself. It's not that you're not interested in what the person is having to say and you're not necessarily trying to censor them. It's just you got to go to a break and you can't help that. These breaks are important. That's how we pay the bills. So I sympathize somewhat with Jake Tapper trying to keep everything short. But my point is, you compare that to what Bernie Sanders was doing, which was coming up with buzzwords to try to avoid talking about the issue, whereas Ted Cruz is actually having the moderators have to cut him off because he's using so many facts and statistics that you can see a real difference there in the quality, in the meat of their argument. Ted Cruz uses a very hearty argument that's filled with things to chew on, things that you can look into. Bernie Sanders are mostly empty. It's like water. And so it's more fluff than anything. But when you're looking at the actual merits of the debate and what was in there, it was a lot of good information. And actually, this is in many ways a problem for Ted Cruz. And why I say that is, Ted Cruz has virtually no emotional appeal whatsoever, which is one of the reasons I like him so much. I don't do emotions. I'm not a feelings guy. Don't mind necessarily those that do, but it's not who I am. And so because of that, I really like Ted Cruz. He's somebody that I relate to. I'm a geek, so I like the facts. I like the statistics. I favor those kinds of arguments because I am a debater myself. The fluff doesn't appeal to me at all, and so I just kind of write it off. And because of that, I really like Ted Cruz, but the average person if you use too many statistics, their eyes start to glaze over. And that's part of the reason that Ted Cruz, even though he did very well in the primaries, I mean, he did come in second place, and he was a much closer second place than most people in the primaries in previous years have been. But still, when you're looking at it, part of the reason that Ted Cruz has a problem appealing to mass audiences is because not everybody is fact-based. In fact, we're getting less and less fact-based as a society now. And so when Donald Trump is yelling out, build the wall, lock her up, all the things that were the catchphrases and the buzz phrases that he used, that appeals to a much broader spectrum of people than Ted Cruz's fact-based, statistic-based conservatism. I'm not saying that Ted Cruz doesn't have any appeal amongst that, amongst the others, because there were a lot of people that liked Ted Cruz and didn't like Trump, or that liked both. There were several people that I talked to that actually were fans of both. Matt Murphy up in Birmingham. I disagreed with him on the Trump issue, but he was also a big fan of Ted Cruz. And so there were people that liked both of those candidates. But Trump appeals to people on a more basic level. He speaks the language of his tribe very well. He's very good at, you know, punking the media, and I'm actually going to talk about that on the tax bill in just a second. But when it comes to Ted Cruz, he has a harder time appealing to audiences because of that, and so I don't know how effective he was on the national stage at actually making his case. But if you're looking at the actual facts and the way they presented themselves, if you're looking at this from the standpoint that I am, in other words, as a debater, then it's obvious that Ted Cruz absolutely ate everybody's lunch, even Tim Scott. Nothing against Tim Scott. I agreed with most of what he said, and he made good points. But you can tell that there's a reason Ted Cruz was a national debate champion. And I mean, it does show when it comes through. And one thing that is different about conservatives and liberals and the way you're looking at this, most of the facts that Cruz and Scott used were based on actual history of when taxes were slashed. They showed comparisons of the economy, how it responded to taxes being brought down, and how it responded to taxes being brought up. And if you look at those two distinctions, it's not only across the board, but they even, and this is one of the things that I love that Ted Cruz brought up, broke it down into individual demographics, including blacks, women, minorities, migrants, all these different categories of how everybody did better. Everybody saw a boost. In fact, the biggest beneficiaries, seemingly, of tax cuts in the 80s were women. So if you want to be pro-woman, which the Democrat Party always claims to be, you should actually be in favor of cutting taxes. And historic and economic evidence is overwhelming that when you cut taxes, you are going to increase government revenues as well, and it benefits the economy as a whole. If you're looking at it by the numbers, there's really no reason anybody on any side of the aisle should be against cutting taxes because of how good it is for the economy and of how good it is for the government, actually. I don't necessarily care about that aspect of it as much, but if you want more money in the coffers of the federal government so that it can do more, I don't. But if you were a Democrat, you would think they would favor tax cuts because it does put more money into the federal budget. Now, I don't necessarily think that that's even a good thing, but the point is it does. The history backs that up. And so I don't understand. The only reason that you could come up with, and the reason that was most oft cited last night by the Democrat side of the debate, was that, well, that's not fair. Really, what they want to do is redistribute wealth. That's all it is. They believe in the Marxist principle of redistributing wealth, of taking it from rich people to give it to poor people. That is part of their core belief system, and that's why, even though it would actually benefit them to slash taxes, they still do not favor it. Now, the best moment of the night, in my opinion, was when Bernie was calling for Democrats and Republicans to work together. And it ended in him and Tim Scott and Ted Cruz arguing. This is a logical fallacy known as the false call to moderation. Now, not every call to moderation is a false call to moderation fallacy. But the reason that this particular one was is because Democrats will never vote for a tax cut. And this is exactly what Ted Cruz pointed out. He's a logical thinker. He understands logical fallacies, and so that was the first thing that he called out. He says the problem is the two sides cannot possibly come together because one side wants to cut taxes, one side wants to increase taxes. There is absolutely no way to reconcile that. If the Democrats want to tax people more and the conservatives want to tax people less, there is no way to get to a point of common interest. That would be like saying, we're going to work together by playing tug of war. Well, you can't do that because you're literally working in opposite directions and your goal is to get the other person on your side. See, this is what happens when the Democrats are not in power. They call for working together. When they are not in power, they call for moderation and working together. When they are in power, they just shove stuff down people's throat and don't care one way or the other. If you don't believe me, look at Obamacare. One of the massive, most transformative bills that has ever come to the floor of the House or the Senate, they passed it without a single Republican vote. Did not even consider working with the Republicans on that, which they won the election. That's part of the way our system works, as much as I hate it, and as much as I think they shouldn't have done it. But at the same time, they do not care about that until they're not the party in power anymore. Then all of a sudden, it makes a big deal to them. Then all of a sudden they're like, well, we really need to work together in bipartisanship. They only call for bipartisanship when it's convenient for them. And Bernie Sanders is not an exception in this. So when you have opposite goals like that, it is impossible for you to work together. And we'll talk a little bit more about not necessarily the debate, but the tax debate as a whole that is happening here in America when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
I recommend a general and public return of praise and thanksgiving to him from whose goodness these blessings descend. John Jay, First Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Welcome back, all. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. Now, going back to what we were talking about beforehand with the tax thing, I actually have a question, and there are a couple different theories on President Trump. A lot of people see him as this master manipulator who is always one step ahead of everybody else. This is sort of the idealistic version of Trump. I don't think that that's the case. I think that people that do espouse this are giving him far too much credit. However, I do have an interesting question for you. This whole Pocahontas thing, I think it was probably an accident. I don't think he intended to do any of this. However, what the national media has been primarily talking about today is that, and then intentionally, and I do know that this was on purpose. I don't know if the motivation I'm about to suggest to you may have been the reason behind it is on purpose. But he intentionally kind of hinted at bringing up the birther thing and bringing up a conspiracy theory on the Billy Bush tapes, you know, the one that has him saying that he's grabbed women by the area there. And don't want to repeat that, of course, because this is a family show. But when it comes to that particular part of it, I think the Native American thing was just a slip of the tongue. I don't think he was thinking at all before he said that, and I think that's part of the problem. But if you're talking about what he was talking about with the birther thing, every time he brings up the birther thing especially, the media loses their freaking minds and talk about it for about a week solid. And I don't know why exactly that is the case. I know it's because they hate Trump and want to bring him down, but I don't know why they think that that has any pull with his supporters. But I remember one thing, and probably the biggest time that Trump ever punked the media is during the campaign where he said he was going to talk about the birther thing, made a big deal about it, told them ahead of time he was going to admit that he was wrong about the birther thing, and then came out and basically gave a 30-minute campaign speech on all the news networks for free. And then the last, like, I don't know, maybe 30 seconds of his speech, he said, by the way, Barack Obama was born here in America. I believe that to be the case. Good night, everybody. I mean, he basically got a 30-minute free campaign speech just because he told people he was going to admit that he was wrong about the birther thing. And they aired the entire thing live. So I do think that Donald Trump has definitely punked the media intentionally before. I wonder if he's doing that right now to give some cover to Congress to get the tax bill through. I don't know if that's the case. I don't necessarily even think that that's the case. But it is an interesting theory to come up with. Maybe that was the motivation between because why else would out of the blue Donald Trump just bring up the Bertha thing? You know, the guy's mind sometimes is a bag of cats. You don't really know what's going on up there. But maybe this one was intentional. Maybe this is just Trump trying to provide some cover to get this tax bill through. And if anybody needs the tax bill to go through other than the American people themselves, first and foremost, it's definitely, definitely Donald Trump. He really needs a win before the end of the year. So, I don't know. Maybe. It's an interesting thing to think about. I don't know if it's the case or not. What bothers me about this whole debate, though, is Republicans cannot cut the government if they are not willing to cut spending. They talk about being the party of small government. They talk about cutting spending and cutting taxes. But right now, the vast majority of the Republicans are doing the absolute best that they can, especially with the CBO, to say that it's deficit neutral. In other words, this is not going to cut revenue. They're trying so hard to make that happen, which, by the way, historically, like I said before, when you do cut taxes, the revenue gathered in the following years actually goes up. You might see a dip in it on that first year, but the revenue actually increases because the economy increases. Therefore, you increase the people that are employed. Therefore, you increase the number of taxpayers, and you increase the amount that individual taxpayers are making because businesses are also able to promote people, give raises, that kind of thing, because the economy is doing well, and they need to do that to stay competitive. Therefore, revenue actually increases when this happens, but let's just pretend that it didn't. Let's just pretend that cutting taxes would mean that the government would be taking in less money from us each year. Why should Republicans fear less money coming into Washington? I do not understand that. I don't understand that at all. Because if we want the government size to shrink, wouldn't it make sense that we need to shrink the revenue as well? If we want it to do less things, why not give it less money to do things, starving the beast? And the only answer that I can come up with is they don't really want to shrink the size of government. You got a couple up there that do. Rand Paul does. Mike Lee does. Ted Cruz does. Interspersed in there are a few of the more moderate ones that still do want to cut the size of government. I believe Marco Rubio genuinely wants the federal government to play a less significant role in our daily lives, and I think he's genuine in that. He's just not quite as conservative as the ones I've just listed. So there are Republican senators that genuinely do want to cut the size of government, but the vast majority of them, I think they don't. I think that's the only way that you can justify them voting the way that they do and talking about government the way that they do. Why are they so afraid of less money being brought into Washington? I mean, that's not what cutting taxes is going to do anyway, but let's just pretend that it is. If that were the case, why is that something that they are so seemingly terrified of? I don't get that. And so, when looking at this, that's just something that I'm having a hard time wrapping my own head around. History shows that the opposite is true. And every single time, regardless of what president did it, revenues always went up. Because it happened under Bush, it happened under Reagan, but you know what? It also happened under Bill Clinton, and it happened under John F. Kennedy. So when we cut taxes, our revenue actually does go up. But here's the thing. Letting people keep their own money, that helps the economy. That's what will help us grow the size of our economy and our individual citizens. Their economic portfolio and their economic freedom. Keep their own money, the money that they earn. We'll be back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Project Veritas and the Washington Post mixing it up. What happened and who came out on top? We go there now on Tactics.
Just try your best. Try everything you can. Don't you worry what they tell themselves. You're away. It just takes some time. A little good and a little out the right. Everything will be just fine. Everything will be all right.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, let me know what is on your mind. Happy to do that here right now at 860-1440 or at Tactics Radio, which is, of course, my Twitter handle. And if you want to go to the Facebook page, you can message me through there as well. Just go to facebook.com/tacticsradio. So it's just that easy. All right, so Project Veritas. Project Veritas is recently in a news story with the Washington Post. An agent of Project Veritas came in posing as a Roy Moore accuser. And she claimed that she had an affair with Moore when back in 1992, and that affair resulted in her having an abortion. The Washington Post, though, had looked into her story, found several holes in it, and wound up turning her away. So this was a sting operation done by Project Veritas. For those of you who don't know, Project Veritas is a, in case you're just blanking on that, they were in the news a lot during the election. They do sting operations primarily on left-leaning groups. They've been responsible for a lot of actually really good stuff being uncovered, mostly against the DNC. So you've got a lot to look for on that. When Project Veritas originally started coming on the scene, it was because they found a lot of stuff on the DNC. Particularly, one thing that they're kind of famous for is they showed that the Clinton operatives in the DNC were working to rig the primaries against Bernie Sanders or anyone else that might arise. So lots of really good stuff, and it even led up to directly to Clinton's campaign specifically. So Project Veritas has done a lot of good so far, but this particular sting operation did not go over all that well. In fact, when their agent left the Washington Post, she went directly to, from that, the Washington Post office to the Project Veritas office. So I don't think that she did a great job of concealing her identity, and that's part of the reason that the Washington Post caught her and was able to stop her doing this. But here's the thing. Here's what's actually at the core of all this, and this should be the takeaway from the story. The reason that the Project Veritas sting operation failed is because Washington Post did their job. They did a background check. They looked into who this woman was. They wanted to see if her claims were true, and they did so before posting the story or writing anything down about it, because that would, of course, been a very big deal if it had turned out that Roy Moore, especially, who is a Christian conservative and has made his career on that, had had an affair back in 1992, because, A, that's a lot more recent than the allegations that he's facing now that are 40 years old, and because he would have been married at that point, of course. The allegations of the things that he did as they are right now, none of them were before his marriage to his wife. So just looking at that right away, that is something that ought to stick out to you. It's clear that this would have been a story that the Washington Post would have wanted to run. They don't like Roy Moore, but the Washington Post did the right thing. And so I think it's very important to give them props on that. I don't necessarily like the Washington Post. They clearly have a very left-leaning slant. They don't like Roy Moore. They don't like Trump. They don't care for Republicans in general. But they did their jobs. In this particular case, the Washington Post did exactly what it was supposed to do as a journalistic organization. So when it comes to Project Veritas, my advice to them would be to tighten up your stories, because if you watch the video of them interviewing the person and sort of raking them over the coals about how some of the details don't really line up, they talk to her about her job and she's like, "Oh, well, I was a real estate agent," and then they get into, "Well, where were you a real estate agent?" "Well, the office was out of Atlanta, but we worked at home and we didn't really see the people in the office that often," and they're like, "Well, where are you working?" And she just kind of drew a blank. So I'm not poking fun at Project Veritas, because obviously the Washington Post did their job and they did their research, and that's why it fell apart, which is what should have happened. But when it comes to Project Veritas, they might need to tighten up the screws a little bit, because obviously the sting operation was pretty easy for the Washington Post to bust. Now, I'm glad that they were able to do it. I'm glad that they were suspicious enough to where they looked into the story before posting it, because that is a good thing for people who care about the truth. That the Washington Post isn't willing to accept just any story that comes on their doorstep because they happen to like the political bend of where it is, which that does inspire a little bit of confidence. Now, is Washington Post still very left-leaning? Yes. Does that mean they get a pass on things from now on? No, not at all. But it does show that they do have at least some journalistic standards, integrity, and reputability when it comes to that. Does this mean that Project Veritas, everything they've ever done, is useless and that they don't get credit for? No, it doesn't mean that either. Project Veritas has done some really good things. This should not be seen as a fight between Project Veritas and the Washington Post. However, I will say, if it were, Washington Post would have definitely come out on top, not only because they caught the person doing the sting operation, but they reported on it. Project Veritas didn't. Project Veritas was clearly playing for a side, the side of Roy Moore. And when they didn't get their way, they just shut up about it. They didn't post a story saying, okay, Washington Post did their job. They didn't post that. They didn't report that. It was Washington Post that came forward and posted it and then tried to get Project Veritas's comment on it. See, the best thing that could have happened is for Project Veritas to have come out and said, look, they got us, which is good. They were doing what they were supposed to do. We thought that they would take any story as long as it was against Roy Moore. Obviously, they did not. But Project Veritas just didn't bring it up and pretended like it didn't happen and hope that nobody would notice. And that's not good for them. See, this does not mean that there is not a left slant against Trump, against Moore. I'm not trying to make that case at all. I'm not trying to say that the media doesn't still hate them. I'm not saying that the media still would not be more apt to run stories against him. I still think to this day, and I think that this doesn't necessarily debunk that, even though it may lend a little less weight to it, that the Washington Post, because they said in their article that originally came out against Roy Moore, they said that they are the ones that sought out the women. It wasn't the other way around. They went to the women, they tried to find out who they were, and then they ran the story based on the interviews and the information that they gathered. Now, they gathered information that was, you know, from their standpoint, at least reputable enough to print. And I've even said that I think that there are at least aspects of truth to that original Washington Post article, the way that it's presented. However, I do think that it was politically motivated. I do think that they wanted to hurt Roy Moore, but at least they did have some standards and checked it out and made sure that their sources were at the very least people that would have been in a situation to have met Roy Moore and had these things happen to them. At least that. I'm not saying that proves anything about Roy Moore. I'm just saying that this does lend the Washington Post at least some level of credibility, and they ought to be applauded for that. You do have to give credit where credit is due because they did their job this time. Now, the reason that I think it is so important to say that is because if we cannot acknowledge when people on the other side of the aisle, people that don't necessarily agree with us, if we cannot acknowledge that the other side did something well, then they would have no motivation for ever doing anything right in the future. I mean, other than just it's the right thing to do, which ought to be motivation enough. But what I'm saying is, if other people on the other side of the aisle all of a sudden say, good job, Washington Post, you got this one right, maybe that encourages them to do the right thing in the future. I think you do have to give credit where credit is due, and that's a big part of that. So I want to know what you think about that. 860-1440 are the numbers. We're getting to your calls in just a moment. And I do want to talk about a couple other things because the Washington Post, that's not the only big news story they were in this week. They were also in one other one, and we will get to that in just a second. Before we do, I want to tell you about our great friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. These guys are absolutely fantastic. They've been in business here in the River Region for 50 years. They've moved locations only once, but their customers followed them. Why? Because they do a great job. It's just as simple as that. They're good at what they do. They do it for a fair price, and they're going to have you in and out as quickly as possible. I remember one time, I think it was in the middle of July or August, I was going in to get a new set of tires, which I was very excited about. I was going to get my new tires on my truck, and that's a big deal for truck owners, as you know, because our tires are expensive. And so it was good that I was finally able to get that and get it done because I'd been riding around on tires that I really shouldn't have been. And so I went in, and I ate lunch on the way there from the office, and I went in, and I was waiting there for so brief a time that when I got out, even in the middle of July, my ice had not melted. It had to have been 98 degrees outside, and it was in a truck with the air conditioner off, and my ice still didn't melt. That's how quickly they were able to get me in and out after purchasing those tires. That's the kind of service that they give every single day, and that's the kind of service that they're going to give to you. So go by and check them out on the Troy Highway. That is Woodham, Southside, Firestone Tire and Auto Center. We have two calls lined up already. We have one more line available for you, 860-1440. We'll get to those calls when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me?
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in, and you can do that right now there, or you can do it on Twitter at Tactics Radio. That's the Twitter handle, so you can do that if you want to. We're going to go ahead and jump to Mark on line one. Good morning. Mark, you
hey,
there?
Okay. Yes, I'm here.
Sorry, I lost you for a second. Yeah, you're good. Go ahead.
Hi, Caleb. Yeah, I noticed, you know, talking about the Washington Post and seeing how they're being a little bit more, what I'm going to say, a little bit more investigative before they go ahead and put this stuff out about Roy Moore. You think about it, when Beverly Nelson, okay, hired Gloria Allred started waving around this yearbook, right, with a signature.
Right.
Okay. And then Roy Moore's attorney, what did he say? He says, well, let's have a handwriting expert look at this signature and let him determine whether it's authentic or not.
Yeah, what was that, about 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, about 2 weeks ago. Now, notice we don't hear that much from Gloria Allred or Beverly Nelson anymore.
Yeah, I noticed that. Now, funny how that works out, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And Gloria Allred declined and refused to have that handwriting signature analyzed. So now I'm thinking, possibly the Washington Post is saying, wait a minute. This Gloria Allred, number one, that should have been the first, you know, no pun intended, red flag.
Right, right. That, I don't know. That may have had something to do with it. I'm not sure, but they may have looked at that and gone, we don't want to get caught up with one of these stories that are pretty clearly false, so maybe we should be a little more choosy about our sources. Maybe that was part of the motivation.
That could have been possibly it right there, but that's really all I wanted to say, because we ain't really heard nothing from them two lately after she declined to have that handwriting signature analyzed. So
yeah, you've noticed they've not been making the media rounds nearly as much as they did the first couple days of that.
Absolutely, and you know what? I heard another talk show host I listened to. It was kind of funny. They said, well, let's see. The Washington Post, their office is exactly right behind, I believe it's the Dirksen Senate building in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they want to investigate sexual inappropriateness and sexual assault, all they had to do is walk across the street. But no, they load up all this stuff and they drive all the way down to Etowah County, Alabama, you know, to find out this information. And it was based on, quote unquote, what they heard.
Right, and that's the thing, Mark, and I appreciate that. Thank you for your call. I do appreciate you calling in and giving us some insight into that. Here's the thing. I don't necessarily believe all the allegations in the Washington Post story, or at least I believe, because I believe in innocent until proven guilty, I believe until there's more concrete proof and it's not just her word against his, then I'm going to continue to operate as though Roy Moore is innocent. And that is a courtesy that I extend to people on both sides of the political aisle. I still can't say concretely whether or not John Conyers is guilty or not. So it has nothing to do with Republican or Democrat, but you're right about that. And I think even if it turns out that every single letter of that Washington Post story turns out to be true, you're still not going to be able to convince me there was not political motivation for writing it. I mean, even if it happens to be true, I still think that the people at the Washington Post, they had already, before that even happened, wrote an editorial piece endorsing Doug Jones. And so it is very clear to me that they did have political motivation for writing the story. Now, just because they wrote the story for political motivation doesn't mean that it's not true, or it doesn't mean that no parts of it are true. But I still think that they wrote it because they don't care much for Roy Moore or the way that he does things. So I think that that was part of the motivation. Let's go ahead and jump to Dave online, too. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. I feel like that guy just said what I wanted to say. that it seems like, to me, my opinion, that sort of like this Comey thing, he wrote his opinion before he even got to the facts. It seemed like they're not doing opposition research, which I don't think they ought to be doing as a news organization. But they are creating the news. You know, they get something, then they speculate for a whole month right prior to an election. But yet you can't really get the facts out. And so they're not reporting on what's going on. They're creating a story.
Well, see,
what it appears to me to be.
Here's the thing, and I cannot confirm that. I don't know this to be the case. Like I said, I do believe that the Washington Post has political motivations behind all this. But if you're looking at the facts as they got them, I believe that they really were gathering information on Roy Moore that they at least believed to be legitimate. Now, whether or not their political affiliation had something to do with whether or not they believed the story is legitimate, I think that's a fair question. But at least in the original Washington Post story, their sources are people that would have been in the area. And I think that probably what happened is that Roy Moore really was dating the girls. But I don't know about the whole sexual part of it, because there is a level of consistency between those stories about the way Roy Moore was back then, the way he treated them, the way that he didn't take it past kissing with all three of the girls except for Korfman. And so if they were just making it up, it seems to me they would have made it more dramatic and more over the top and something that was actually illegal with the other three girls as well. So I don't necessarily think that it's completely manufactured. And that's the problem that I'm having with it.
Yeah, I can agree with you on that.
All right.
I just think these gals waited.
Oh, no, the timing is suspect. Don't get me wrong on that. The timing is incredibly suspect.
Oh, very so. And just the fact it must have really not bothered him that badly, because he's run so many times. And if you really wanted to get him, you could have gotten him years ago.
Right. Why not?
Anyway.
Why not 30 or 40 years ago? Not in 2000 when he was running for Chief Justice? I mean, that's the problem that I have with it.
Well, I as well. So thank you for taking the call.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it. And we have one more caller that just jumped in. Let's go to line one. Good morning. Oh, I guess they jumped right back out again. So we will soldier on, though. Nonetheless, well, I'll tell you what, we're actually at the 10:30 mark, so why don't I just go ahead and take a commercial break right now. The Washington Post was actually in another story, and they ran it, and I want to give them props on that one, too, because they did a good job on that. It's not one that necessarily lines up with, I know, the political opinion of a lot of people at the Washington Post, and it has to do with the president. So I'm going to give them credit for, again, doing the right thing twice in 1 week. Props to you, Washington Post. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Righteousness alone can exalt a nation. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. As always, at Tactics Radio. That is the Twitter handle if you'd like to tweet me. And you can go to the Facebook page, facebook.com/Tactics Radio. So I was telling you about this Washington Post story. This was fascinating to me. The media did not care. And I mean, this shouldn't surprise any of us. But the media did not care about Hurricane Maria until they could use it as a way to attack Trump. You remember Hurricane Maria was the one that hit Puerto Rico? Now, y'all know, I am not a blindfolded Trump worshiper. I didn't even vote for the man. So when you're asking about whether or not I support him now that he's the president, just because, you know, I want the president to do well because I want the country to do well. But as far as, you know, being in favor of him, voting for, didn't do any of that. And I've been a pretty vocal Trump critic. Even while he's in the White House, because I believe that's my job. But I have always, even in all my criticism of the man, maintained that there is a very clear and predominant anti-Trump bias in the media. And even Jimmy Carter agrees. Anybody that's honest that is watching the media can tell they do not like Trump. And Trump doesn't much care for them, and I think that's a fair assessment to make as well. But nonetheless, they're constantly fighting with each other, even though they seem to constantly want each other's attention. But nonetheless, so this latest Washington Post story confirms that in relation to Puerto Rico, the hurricane story from there, that the media really didn't care about the story until all of a sudden they could use it as an opportunity to attack Donald Trump. And props to Washington Post for posting this, because it ain't because they like Trump. And so, again, I rarely praise the Washington Post, but I'm going to do it twice in one show because they deserve it. They did it twice in 1 week. Why not give them a pat on the back? Like I said, if we're unwilling to compliment those that we disagree with when they do a good job and when they do, you know, put something out there objectively, if we fail to compliment them on that, I fear that they will not do it again. So maybe if they start seeing that people respect seeing some objective journalism, then they'll start doing a little bit more of it. I don't know, but, you know, it's worth a try. So this latest Washington Post story about it was based off of a survey from the MIT Media Lab that looked at over 80 print and online media outlets, which showed that more than 1,100 news outlets were covering the story, covering Harvey and Irma, while only 500 were carrying Maria to start out with. So already more than double the coverage of Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Now, there's a lot of different reasons for that. I think there was a little bit of hurricane fatigue. And I also think that because they had been covering two of them, there was some hurricane fatigue and they understood that people were kind of tired of hearing about hurricanes and the relief efforts. And then also, I believe a lot of it had to do with the fact that it was Puerto Rico, because unfortunately, there was a poll that was taken right around that time that showed that half of Americans didn't even realize that Puerto Ricans were American citizens. Puerto Rico is an American territory, but they didn't realize that. They thought it was a different country. So because of that, I think that people, American readers at least, didn't associate themselves with them quite as much. And because of that, there was less desire to consume media about it. However, if you're looking at the media coverage, and that's exactly what this survey did, the media coverage of Maria was scarce by comparison for the first 5 days. Like we just said, less than half compared to Harvey and Irma. So what was the media covering back when that was going on? Well, the top story was Donald Trump's comments on the NFL. That's what they wanted to talk about. That's what they thought was so important. And that's what I was talking with Donald Jenkins when we were doing the exchange with Kevin's show right before we came in. I was like, well, the media, that's one of the things they do. The man just tweets about something, and that's all the media can talk about for 2 days. So there is a lot of power there. But Donald Trump, of course, comments on the NFL. He tweets about it, and then he gives the speech actually right here in favor of Luther Strange in Alabama. And because of that, that's all the media was talking about over the weekend and the days of the early days of the Maria relief effort. They only started paying attention to the Maria story when San Juan's mayor went after Trump. So you have that story, San Juan's mayor interviewed, I think on that Sunday. She starts going after Trump, talking about how horrible the relief efforts are and how it's all Donald Trump's fault. And then all of a sudden it became this massive news story. Coverage took a massive, massive dip in the Hurricane Maria story when Trump visited the island on the 3rd. They covered his actual visit, but right after that visit took place, things started to go really well, and then the media coverage all of a sudden just kind of went away. So you can see a very clear pattern here, and in this story, if you look it up, they actually have a graph that shows how much the media was covering the Maria story and how many publications were posting stuff about it. And you can see that there is a very, very clear spike, and it happens long after the story started. Starts right there when San Juan's mayor started talking about how bad Trump was. Spikes, goes up, hits a peak, and then when he visits on October 3rd, drops like a rock. So obviously, to the media, this story was nothing other than a weapon to hit Trump over the head with. And that's the only reason they cared about it. Now, this study also showed that coverage was far more political. So when you're looking at Maria, the coverage was more political than the coverage they were giving to Harvey and Irma. And if you're looking at the words that were used, and they took a survey of this as well, all the stories they looked at, the words Congress, Senate, Democrats, Republicans, debt, and tax were the most commonly used words in the Puerto Rico story. So they weren't even really talking about the victims. They were talking about politics. They were talking about Republicans and Democrats. They were talking about what's going on in the Senate. They were talking about debt and taxes and how much it was going to cost and all this stuff. they weren't concerned about the people, or at least not as much as they had been in Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Because if you're comparing to, for example, the Hurricane Harvey coverage, the words victim and family were the ones that were most used in Hurricane Harvey. So, apparently, that's all this story was to the media. And this shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody. Like I said, even though I'm not exactly a huge Trump supporter, I still have been able to acknowledge, and I think that any honest broker can look at it and acknowledge, the media has a very clear and present bias against Trump. They don't like the guy. And this story proves that point. So props to MIT, which is not exactly a far conservative organization, for coming up with this survey and posting the truth. And props to Washington Post for picking up the story and getting the word out there. Now, the bottom line is this. While the media was busy crowing about Trump, not caring about Puerto Rico, saying that he was a racist, saying that all these terrible things that he did not want to spend money or spend time on them because that these were Hispanic people, apparently they didn't care about it either. Or at least they didn't care about it until all of a sudden they saw it as an opportunity to attack Trump. So by their standard, I guess the mainstream media is racist. Because wasn't that what they were accusing Trump of? They said, well, he doesn't care about these people because they're Latino. You remember there was even the SNL sketch where he said, you just did this for white people a few weeks ago with Harvey. Why can't you do it in Puerto Rico? Well, there's a lot of reasons he couldn't do it for Puerto Rico. First of all, Puerto Rico is an island. And when this hurricane hit, it shut down all the infrastructure. So they only had one working port and I think two working airports. It was very hard to get relief efforts in. Second of all, have you seen Texas? Have you seen the Houston area? And I'm not just making this up. You remember when we were covering this story the first time, we actually looked at the stats. Overwhelmingly Latino. White people aren't even the majority in Houston, especially in the areas that were hit by the hurricane. And yet somehow that makes Donald Trump a racist. Well, if that's true, media, by your own standard, you are also racist because you didn't care about the story until it was an opportunity to go after Trump. I'm sorry, but that's what the numbers show. That's why you don't make standards that you can't stick to, because sometimes, as Andy Griffith would say, you get your britches hung on your own pitchfork. This just shows, though, that priority number one for these people is political agenda, not covering the news. If they were worried about covering the news, they would have given it equal time for Harvey and Irma and all that stuff and wouldn't have cared whether or not they could use it as an opportunity to attack Trump. But all of a sudden, when there was blood in the water and when they sensed that they could score some political points, then all of a sudden it becomes the top story. Then it's a big deal. Not before, not after. Then Trump comes in. The media efforts start going very smoothly. Everything starts clearing up, not because Donald Trump all of a sudden started paying attention to it, but because it was a storm, and once they got the roads working and got the airport going, then they could start getting things moving. We saw virtually the same thing, not exactly, but virtually the same thing happened with Katrina. There were a lot of people fussing about the slow relief efforts, but they can't make the water recede. I mean, they can't just make the city all of a sudden navigable. It took them a while to get down there. And so the media, really to them, all this was a way to score some political points. And I will say this, props to WAPO for doing their job and putting politics aside twice in the same week. So good job, Washington Post. I don't say it often. You know, I hate to sling insults here, especially when I'm complimenting you, because you really don't deserve it that often. But I have done it before. I'll do it again. Anytime I see some objective journalism from you, you're going to get a round of applause from me. That goes for any of the other mainstream media outlets. Chaplin's Report is next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Matthew 28, 19 and 20. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in, at Tactics Radio if you want to tweet me. Let's go ahead and jump into the Chaplain's Report. Now, for those of you who may not have been listening all week, we've been doing a series on internal truths of the Scripture. So there are lots of different proofs of the scripture. If you're looking at the field of apologetics, you can look at historical data. You can look at the different ways that the Bible was put together. You can look at, prophecy, all kinds of things. Today we're going to talk about a different one, scientific foreknowledge. So one of the things that's interesting about this is because God, of course, being the creator of the universe, he understands how science works. He understands how the world works. And though it's not something that happens often in Scripture, we have little tidbits here and there in the Bible that turned out they were true and scientifically years ahead of their time. So reading some of these, I'm just going to go through one and then I might give a couple other benefit or a couple others through reference. This one comes from Isaiah 40:22. It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. So this is one of Isaiah's writings. And you'll notice that in the Bible, you don't see any mention of the earth being flat. And in fact, right here, you're seeing the earth referred to as a circle. There wasn't really a Hebrew word for sphere. So he says he sits above the circle of the earth. So the early Hebrew writer Isaiah, through the gift of inspiration, understood that the world is round, not flat. So you may be asking yourself, well, when did this knowledge come to fruition? Nobody really thought the earth was round until, as far as we can tell, 500 BC by Pythagoras. He was a Greek philosopher. Then about 150 years after that, we have Aristotle famously saying that he believed that the earth was round, but it wasn't even really proven then. There were people that thought the earth was round, especially ones that had studied Aristotle, but it wasn't believed to be round until Columbus proved it, of course, in the 1490s. So we have Isaiah. When was that written? Sometime between 700 BC and about 681 BC. That's where most scholars put its authorship. So, roughly 200 years before the first Greek philosopher came up with this idea that the earth is round. And by the way, his reasoning was the moon is round, ergo the earth must be round as well. We have Isaiah writing in his book of prophecy saying that the earth is a circle. So there are little scientific truths that are just occasionally worked in to the scripture at any given time. There was also evidence that Jewish laws understood a lot of medical phenomenon. There's a lot of things in the law of Moses that would far predate medical knowledge. That was actually a very healthy practice to have. Now, it doesn't say that it's for your health, but a lot of God's dietary laws, for example, would have been healthier. For example, a lot of the foods that were clean and unclean, the ones that were unclean were the ones that were also less healthy, and most of the time that was because of parasites. There were a couple other reasons as well. For example, they were not allowed to eat camels, for example, but they were able to, and they weren't able to eat horses, for example, but they were able to eat cattle, they were able to eat sheep, they could not eat shellfish, they could not eat fish that didn't have scales. Why? Because fish's scales protect them from things like parasites. Catfish doesn't have scales, and it's also a bottom feeder. It eats primarily waste, and because of that, it has a lot of parasites. Now, if you can cook them properly, and with the technology that we have now, it's really not a problem. But they didn't have that technology back then. Of course, the most famous things that they were unable to eat were swine. Well, swine also tend to attract parasites. And if you do not cook pork properly, it can make you very sick. And so the laws of Moses, the dietary laws, just said, hogs, don't even bother with them, don't eat them. So a lot of these dietary laws were set up despite not understanding what parasites were and not understanding that these foods can make you sick, at least some of the time. And yet, years and years and years ahead of their time when telling them that they should not do that. And believe me, this was not just a cultural thing, because swine were very popular amongst the surrounding areas. In fact, if you're looking at archaeologists, the way that a archaeologist, secular or somebody that believes in the scripture regardless, when they're looking up the remains of, for example, a village, if they don't find any pork bones in the Middle East, they assume that it was a community of Jews. Because Jews were the ones that did not eat pork. Now, if it was a little later, for example, Muslims also don't eat pork, and so now you could look it up and maybe it's a 14th century or 13th century Muslim village. But by and large, if they find a village that dates from the era of the time where the Jews would have been in Jerusalem, they assume that there was if there are no pig bones anywhere near there, they say that it must be swine free because it was a Jewish village. So this was something that was unique to the Jews. It was unique to the law of Moses. It was not a cultural thing because the people around them all ate pork. Also, the laws about washing your hands. That is an evidence of God's foreknowledge of germ theory. Of course, God knows about bacteria. He knows that that's what makes you sick. And so a lot of their laws about germs, touching germs, washing their hands, those would have been things that God would have known about that the Jews wouldn't. They wouldn't have understood the reason behind that law, but those were laws for a reason. You can even see the Pharisees get very upset when the tradition of the elders and the washing of hands is not observed. So germ theory was not discovered until John Snow put the theory together in the very late 1800s. Germ theory wasn't a thing back then. That's why when they would operate on people, they would take the instruments from one surgery and move them to the next surgery. I mean, that was like the Civil War. That wasn't even ancient history. Now we don't even think about it, but germ theory is a relatively new scientific idea. And yet, God evidently knows about it centuries and centuries before anybody else did. The Levitical laws also, if you're talking about germ theory, commanded the proper handling of sewage and the dead. This is actually a command in Deuteronomy that you're supposed to go out and dig a hole, and that's where your refuse goes. So it was basically telling them that that's how you build outhouses, you bury it. And this was, again, not necessarily a practice that was common to other societies around them. It became a common practice later on. But this is something that very much predated the time that the law of Moses would have been established in. And, of course, it was far more sanitary than putting it somewhere else. And the same thing with the dead. If you handled a dead person, and there were people, of course, that had to do that, had to prepare their body for burial, we even see that in the Gospels. But once you touched a dead person, you were unclean and you had to go through a purification process because God understood that that is something that attracts germs and other things. So there are a lot of these internal proofs that if you're looking through the Bible, it just shows that God has a knowledge of science long before anybody else did. And that's one of the proofs that the Bible is, without a doubt, the inspired word of an all-knowing, all-seeing God. You see, science is the study of the natural world and the natural order, and God, as the creator of that order, it should come as no surprise that he understands that. In a sense, God is the ultimate scientist. People accuse Christians of being anti-science. They are the followers of the creator of science. Stay the course, friends. No.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.